I'm going to go ahead and get started. Steve, I know you're ready. Our last session is on the auditor's reporting model. As I'll discuss in a few minutes, we've been doing a lot of work, a lot of outreach on this effort. The investor advisory group also heard a presentation last week. So we're interested, want to share with you some of the comments from what we've learned from the IAG, and also get, most importantly, comments from you as we help move forward. But to help us get started, let me turn it over to our board member, Steve Harris. Steve?
Well, thank you, Jennifer, and we're into the home stretch on a dispassionate subject, which, as Arnie pointed out, there'll probably be little debate and little discussion, so I assume people get out of here in a hurry because nobody will have anything to say. But as you pointed out, earlier this week, the board heard a presentation from Marty and his team on the staff's outreach efforts to investors, preparers, audit committee members, auditors, academics, and others on possible changes to the auditor's report. At that meeting, Chairman Doty instructed the Office of the Chief Auditor to move forward on development of a concept release for the board's consideration on or about June 30th, a roundtable discussion in the fall, and a proposed standard in the first quarter of 2012. And I do periodically have discussions with the chairman about whether we're leading or whether we're following the international community, but I do want to commend the chairman and also the former acting chairman, Dan Geltzer, for their leadership on this issue, and I think we are leading the world, and I think we have that responsibility. Today, you will hear an overview of the staff's findings and have an opportunity to discuss some possible changes to the auditor's report. As I said at Tuesday's open meeting, the board's mandate from the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002 is to protect the interest of investors in the preparation of informative, and I want to stress the word informative, audit reports. And I believe that this project is an important step for the board to take in fulfilling that directive. The usefulness of the auditor's report has been studied by various groups and organizations for decades, both domestically and internationally, resulting in virtually no change. The fact that questions about the usefulness of the audit report have resurfaced around the world is not surprising. Given recent events, and I am referring to the financial crisis, as well as the increasing complexity of business and financial reporting standards, it is no wonder investors are asking for more information. Last week at a meeting of the PCOB's Investor Advisory Group, Joe Carcello, who is also a member of that group in addition to this one, made what I thought was a compelling presentation regarding investors' key views on improving the auditor's report. Gus Sauter of Vanguard, Norman Harrison, formerly of Breeden Capital, and Ann Yerger of the Council of Institutional Investors joined Joe in making the presentation. Also participating in the research and preparation of the presentation were Brandon Becker of TIA CREF, Michael Head of TD Ameritrade, Bonnie Hill of Eichen Blue, Pete Nachtway of Legg Mason, Ann Simpson of CalPERS, and Eric Vincent of Osprey Management. Under Joe's leadership, the group surveyed leaders from investment banks, hedge funds, private equity funds, mutual funds, endowments, and pension funds on the usefulness of the current auditor's report and suggestions for improvements. Responses to that survey represented well over $8 trillion under management, and it was clear that investors want more from auditors. In particular, the survey results indicate that investors want auditors to discuss their assessment of management's estimates and judgments and how the auditors arrived at that assessment. They also want auditors to discuss areas of high financial statement and audit risk, unusual transactions, and the quality of an issuer's accounting practices and policies. Investors have indicated a need for this type of information to better anticipate certain events of issues or issues impacting the financial statements. They cite the recent financial crisis as an example of where expanded auditor reporting in advance of the crisis may have been helpful in assessing the quality of the financial statements underlying their investments. The auditor's reporting model has been discussed several times over the past few years by both this group and the board's investor advisory group. Investors have long indicated that they are the auditor's customer, and therefore the auditor's responsibility is to report in a manner which meets their needs. It's clear that investors are seeking more useful and relevant information from the auditor beyond the current pass-fail auditor's report. And investors are looking to the auditor, not management, not the audit committee, but to the auditors for this additional information. Before turning the discussion over to Jennifer, I would like to commend you and your team, Marty, in absentia. Marty, we commend you for your dedication to advancing this project. And I will leave you with one last quote from Michel Barnier, the Commissioner for Internal Market and Services at the European Commission, who said at a recent EC conference on its green paper, quote, "The status quo is not an option for the auditing world. It's not about changing for the sake of change, but to reply to very real needs which we can no longer ignore." Jennifer, I turn it over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Well said, and good way to start off our session. So in our last session of the day, I have two very important goals for this session. First is to provide you with an overview of the outreach that we, Marty, I, and I'm joined by members of my team, Jessica Watts, Dan Mudzik, and Deanne Jules. We've been actively busy since October doing outreach with investors, preparers, audit committee members, auditors, and others on the auditor's reporting model. So I'll provide you with an overview of what we've heard. And secondly, and most importantly, in my view at least, and will help us in moving forward with the concept release, is to get your views, input from you, on some possible areas we've identified, we've heard, of ways the auditor's report could change. So your thoughts on that will be most welcome and quite relevant and timely to us as we move forward, as we busily move forward working on the concept release. Regarding our outreach, I know many of you have come and told me that you've listened to the presentation that we gave to the board 2 days ago. And to those of you who did that, I give you gold stars. For those who were not able to, no worries. It's available on our website. You can listen to a webcast. I think you can get an iPod. You listen to it on your iPod, Jessica tells me. So you could go ahead and do that. It was a presentation we gave to the board, which about 30 minutes or so, Marty and I, followed by an hour and a half discussion, questions from our board members, which brought out a lot of issues from our outreach. So I don't have time to go through that in detail today, and many of you have already heard it, but I want to share with you some of the highlights to put then the discussion in context of possible changes. Last October, first to set the stage, all last year at each of our SAG meetings, we've talked about the auditor's reporting model to some extent or another with the standing advisory group. Last April, we had a very in-depth discussion talking about it. We got into breakout sessions talking about in more detail what the board could do, what were the areas of change that were needed. And then we decided really largely in large part, based on advice from this group, we undertook additional outreach, and we announced last October that we were planning to do outreach with investors and other users on changes to the auditor's report. So from October, as soon as our SAG meeting ended practically, through March of this year, the Office of the Chief Auditor conducted in-person meetings and held conference calls with over 80 individuals, consisting of investors, preparers, audit committee members, auditors, regulators and standard setters, and academia. The participants represented a very diverse group of organizations and companies, both domestic and international, as well as small, medium, and large size companies. As we went through our outreach, we first met with investors. Certainly, they've expressed loud and clear, not just recently, but for decades, that change is needed. So we wanted to first meet with investors. Our mission is to investors to find out exactly what changes were needed in the report, what they wanted, and to figure out how that could be done. We then met with preparers, auditors, audit committee members to share with them what we've been hearing from investors and to get their thoughts on how changes could be made or any concerns they had regarding some of the areas for change that investors were seeking. So let me tell you what we heard from investors first. One theme came across very loud and clear, and really in every single discussion that we had. Investors desire change. And there's, in all the areas of change, and I wouldn't say one investor had the exact same list as another, but certainly what came across was five key areas where change, where they would like to see change occur. The first is they want to know more about the audit or what the auditor did. They'd like to know what information, you know, what risks the auditor identified. They'd like to know what the auditor's materiality assessments were. Some would like to know about the engagement statistics. So they'd like to know how many hours were spent on significant areas in the financial statements. And also independence. They'd like to know more about auditor independence, potentially some of the types of issues that the auditor discusses with the audit committee about matters affecting auditor's independence. So first was more about the audit or what the auditor did. Second area, they'd like to know the auditor's views on the company's financial statements or what did the auditor find. I think many of the areas that Joe's group touched on at the IAG meeting last week or made a presentation about, several of those areas I think fall into this particular category. It goes into auditors' views on management's estimates and judgments and areas of high risk. Could include difficult or contentious issues, auditors' views on accounting policies. So that's the second area. The third is investors would like to see clarifications in certain language used in the current auditor's report. For instance, there's nothing in the auditor's report today that describes anything about the auditor's responsibility for fraud. They'd like to see, investors realize auditors do have a responsibility for fraud, so they'd like that more clearly articulated in the auditor's report. Also, the auditor provides a report based on reasonable assurance that the financial statements are fairly presented in all material respects. They'd like a better understanding of what it means. What does reasonable assurance mean? They know it's not absolute, but it does represent a high level of assurance. So at minimum, they like to see that explained. And another is the disclosures that, you know, we just had a discussion about disclosures. They know an auditor has a responsibility to evaluate disclosures as part of the financial statements, so articulate that responsibility in the report. The four key area that came through from investors is they like to have clarity, or some would say enhanced responsibility for auditors' responsibility for information outside of the financial statements. So that includes MD&A, non-GAAP information, and earnings releases. The auditor's responsibility today is to read and consider other information. So they read and consider the MD&A to determine whether anything in the company's MD&A is materially inconsistent with the financial statements or represents a material misstatement of fact. Some have said they'd at least like to understand that. Some have said they thought the auditors may audit that. So at least articulate what the responsibility is. And some have said it might be nice to have some additional auditor, you know, some type of assurance responsibility, auditor's responsibility for that other information. And the fifth key area is investors would like to obtain information similar to key issues shared between the auditor and the audit committee. Many investors know that the auditors have a very robust dialogue and they have required communications to the audit committee on many of the areas they're interested in, such as significant accounting policies, management judgment and estimates, among others. At the IAG meeting last week, the themes from investors were very consistent with what we heard in our outreach. So after we met with investors, our next step was to meet with preparers, audit committee members, and auditors. And I'll just share some of the common themes we heard from those three groups, because I think they're very consistent among the three of them. So in meeting preparers, audit committee members, and auditors, generally do not believe that the auditor should provide information that is not fact-based and subjective in nature. They think that any additional information they provide should be fact-based and doesn't have that level of subjectivity. They raised concerns that the auditor provided information that was in addition to or potentially conflicted with management's disclosures. It could have a couple effects which are not desirable. For example, it could obscure the responsibilities of management, the audit committee, and the auditor. For instance, if the auditor is the original source of information, then if it's management's responsibility, as Arnie articulated in the last session, to prepare financial statements, then does that just an inherent conflict? And also, audit committees have a responsibility in their oversight role to act on behalf of investors on the financial statements, to oversee the financial statement process. That includes the audit committee's responsibility to meet with both management and the external auditors. So if the auditor is down the original source of information, what does that say about the role of the audit committee? And also, the second major concern that came through was if the auditor disclosed additional information that wasn't fact-based and more subjective, it could have a potential negative effect on the relationship between management, the audit committee, and auditors. For example, some have said that management may be less willing to be or less open if they had concerns that the auditor may say something different than what they had said, or the audit committees may be less willing to be as open. So they're concerned about the potential effect it could have on the relationship. There are some other concerns that came up as well as far as providing additional information, and particularly information that isn't as fact-based. There were concerns about the cost and time it would take or that would result of providing such information. For example, time, if you think about the time that's spent preparing management's financial statements and MD&A or just the MD&A, there's a significant amount of time that goes into that by management. Then their counsel, general counsels review that. Their audit committees review it. So it's a very robust process. Similarly, if an auditor were to provide, like an auditor's discussion and analysis, many auditors felt a similar lengthy process would need to go through, that there would need to be some type of consistency. There'd be a lot of discussions with the company and the audit committee. The firm, national office, would need to review that to make sure as a firm they're being consistent in the types of information that was being disclosed. So there was concerns about the additional time that would take, which would therefore lead to an increase in cost. So moving forward, I guess on a positive note, while preparers, audit committees, and auditors were not supportive of changes that are not fact-based, as I just described, they were supportive of other changes. And in my view, I think in meeting with all of those groups, I sensed certainly an indication that change was needed or was appropriate to include in the auditor's report. Each of those groups had identified areas where change could occur. One was clarifying certain language in the auditor's report. That's one of the things that investors said they were interested in. So that goes to describing auditors' responsibilities for fraud, reasonable assurance, et cetera. Another was clarifying in an auditor's report what an audit does and does not represent. Some expressed concerns that an audit is essentially a clean bill of health on a company's financial, condition. The financial statements are intended to represent the results of the company. That could be good or bad, but it's presenting that information, and the opinion goes that information is presented fairly. But that audit does not represent that the company will continue, that they don't have significant business risks or things like that. So it, doesn't go to financial health. It goes to the fairness of the financial statements. So clarifying language in the report about what an audit does and does not represent. Another area where there was support for change is referring readers to significant areas in the financial statements such as critical accounting policies or estimates, by including references to management's disclosures. By doing that, while it would not be providing additional information or information that may be inconsistent with, it would be highlighting, you know, auditors' views on some of the significant areas. And so it does provide that, and then with references to where management's disclosures can be found. So that summarizes the views we heard at a very high level from investors, preparers, audit committee members, and auditors. We then, after hearing all of that, focused on possible ways for change, and that's really where I'm interested in some of your thoughts today. With regard to the audit report today, I guess before I get to the supplemental, I'll move it back so you're not focused on the slide at the moment. We asked investors about the current pass-fail report today. Is that appropriate? Should it be retained? Does it have any value? And what we heard, I think very consistently, is investors generally believe that the existing report should continue to make clear whether the financial statements are presented fairly or not. So in other words, to continue to have a pass-fail opinion, although investors, as I indicated earlier, said they would like language clarified in the report. What investors most desire to receive, though, is additional information from the auditor. So that came through with information about what the auditor did, what the auditor found, responsibilities for other information. The supplemental report would not modify the overall pass-fail opinion, but would provide additional information about the audit and what the auditor found. So there's three different possibilities that we heard as a possible way forward. So I'll describe each of these areas, and really then the remainder of the discussion like to focus on your thoughts on feasibility of these options and how we could potentially make requirements for auditors to write informative reports, supplemental reports. So the first option is auditors' discussion and analysis, or many have called AD&A for short, like MD&A. This format would have the appropriate language that would discuss that the AD&A is integral to the understanding of the audit opinion as a whole on the financial statements. However, it's not intended to represent separate assurance on any individual account, transaction, or disclosure. It could include all or some of the following. So it could include information about the audit, what the auditor did. So that would be materiality, what risks did the auditor identify. Could include information about the financial statements, auditor's views on the financial statements. And so that goes to some of the areas about auditor's views on management judgment and estimates, auditor's views on the quality, not just acceptability, of the accounting policies. Or it could include information about both the audit and auditor's views on the financial statements. The second area is an auditor emphasis of matters and statement of audit approach. Today in our auditing standards provide that auditors could emphasize certain matters, and that was discussed at the IAG meeting last week, and I think one person that one person that was surveyed in the discussion last week indicated that generally it's rarely used, and if at all, and today it's mostly around going concern. So one option is we could really require that for certain areas, that the auditor would emphasize matters. And there's also another type of report that exists today some of you may be familiar with or recall because we discussed it last April at our SAG meeting, is the French model report. So I view this option like a French model report, but maybe more. But that would be the structural foundation. But in the French model, in my view, it's like an emphasis of matter type of report. It highlights, it has what they call a justification of assessments section where the auditor really highlights about five significant areas. And it talks about what the auditor did overall, some of the auditor's overall procedures and testing, and then points to the financial statement disclosures. So it doesn't provide anything necessarily conflicting with what's disclosed by management, but some have said that type of format might have some benefits because, one, the auditor would highlight kind of the key areas that they identified. And two, with just highlighting those areas, it could cause management to have heightened attention or the audit committee on those disclosures, you know, if they were considered important by the auditor, to make sure that they are robust or gives investors some additional assurance on those disclosures. So that's the second area. And the third area that I'm interested in your feedback on is auditors' association with MD&A or, you know, reporting on MD&A or selected portions of it. One area that came up was that auditors could report on the critical accounting estimate section of the MD&A. As I mentioned previously, MD&A is not audited per se. There's no, auditors don't provide reasonable assurance on MD&A. So one option is auditors could report on that. This option would require SEC action, I believe, and we have had the SEC very much engaged in what we've been doing and apprised. So this option likely would require some type of change by them. But, you know, I don't know if some have viewed this might be a desirable option because those disclosures in MD&A are often, you know, seems to be many of the things that investors are interested in regarding auditors' views of, you know, the company's financial statements. So pointing to this and the auditor providing additional assurance, you know, may be of some benefit. So very interested in your views now. I'd like to hear from you now that I've spoken for the past few minutes. Interested in hearing your views on these options. Also, if you have a view as to one particular option, if you have any thoughts as far as what the audit requirements would look like. We've had some concerns that, you know, some are fearful of boilerplate disclosures by the auditor. So if you have any thoughts about how we could write the requirements so that they are robust by the auditor and not boilerplate, that seems to have a negative connotation, that would be very helpful. And I'm sorry. And, of course, I presented a very high overview of our findings, but if you had any particular questions about that, we'd be happy to answer any questions on those as well. So I see Doug Carmichael.
Just a suggestion. I think that I'd eliminate that third alternative. I think what you might do is take the requirement for the auditor's discussion and analysis and make it one of the things that the auditor would discuss would be all of the critical accounting policies. So if management makes disclosure in the MD&A of the critical accounting policies, then one of the things that the auditor would need to discuss in the auditor's discussion and analysis would be the audit approach to each of those critical accounting policies. So I think you could accomplish the important things that the auditor would be able to comment on by the requirements in another approach without getting the auditor involved in the MD&A, which is supposed to be a narrative discussion of the financial statements to let the investor see the financial statements through the eyes of management. And it just doesn't seem appropriate to get the auditor involved in that and something that's supposed to be insights from management. I think what would be valuable would be insights from the auditor on the audit in an auditor discussion and analysis. Rather than in the MD&A. The MD&A requirements, when they first came into being, were the results were very boilerplate. And I think you can expect the same thing with an auditor discussion and analysis. That it will, you can try to avoid that, but you probably need to view it more as an evolving process where you will state broad requirements and then continually to give implementation guidance based on the inspections of the auditor's work in accomplishing those objectives. It would be desirable to set requirements that wouldn't result in boilerplate, but I guarantee that that's what will happen, and it'll only be an evolving process to get away from that.
So just to make sure I heard you correctly, Doug, you're in favor of an ADNA approach, but was it anchored toward the critical accounting policies?
Yeah, I was just
and
suggesting
talk about the audit approach.
That would be one of the things that you could require be included in the auditor's discussion and analysis would be to speak to each of the critical accounting policies, and that you could accomplish any objectives that might be picked up by the third one without actually getting the auditor involved in the process of the MD&A, which would have a lot of disadvantages.
Okay, thank you. Wayne Collins.
Yeah, I just had a question on the feedback that you got from the audit committee representatives, preparers, and the auditors, that group. I think you said use the word fact-based, that they should only be involved with fact-based matters. I just wanted to get a better understanding of the context of what fact-based means and in order to get appropriate context of it. Some examples, perhaps.
Well, I think fact-based was meant not subjective or not really in conflict with management's disclosures. So management, as far as estimates, discussion of, estimates, critical accounting policies, critical accounting estimates, and management has its views and disclosures in the financial statements about those. And many investors have said they like to know the auditor's views about, okay, they recognize, estimates fall within, there's a number chosen within a range. And auditors may have had some discussions with the audit committee and management about where that falls on the range. Maybe it's starting to shift within the range. Do they feel that the company consistently tends to be at one end of the range or versus the other? Investors really view auditors, the audit process as being important, as being robust. And many companies, they pay millions of dollars for an audit. They know auditors spend 1,000 hours. And the report, which is one page, doesn't provide that much. They're interested in, the auditor has an independent third party hired to do a very important job and interested in the views they, from the auditor. They know, for example, in a private transaction on an acquisition of an entity, an auditor may be hired to help do due diligence for the company that wants to acquire the target. And auditors often write due diligence reports that are very lengthy, certainly more than one page, talking about any concerns about possible, the financial accounting policies, estimates, ranges, many different factors, and that's the type of information that they had concerns with disclosing in a public report because concerns that they may not understand the context of all of that.
I'll add to that a little bit. I think information about the audit, what the auditor viewed as key risks and what the auditor did in response to that might be fact-based, as opposed to information about the auditor's subjective view as to the reasonableness of an input to an assumption is a subjective matter. And the second category, emphasizing certain matters in the footnotes being important, fact-based, and what the auditor's approach was. So it's really difference between more objective information versus subjective information.
Okay, Larry Salva.
Yeah, thanks. I guess I'm not as troubled maybe as some of the others with whether it's subjective or objective or fact-based. Auditors are professionals, and if they've formed a professional view that management's estimates tend to be biased towards low end or high end of ranges, if that's the view that they take out of the audit, I'm, as I said, probably not, maybe not as troubled as others might be with them expressing that view at the conclusion of their audit. I think that does provide some insight, the management's approach to preparing the financial statements. But I do think that We have to remember, or at least I think we need to separate the function of assertion is the responsibility of management, and auditors attest, and it's only they should only be put in a position of providing additional information to the extent that it's needed to supplement what's been asserted by management. So if management assertion is the financial statements, and then they need to provide additional supplemental information, just as if they were to take an adverse opinion, you would provide more information about what would have to be adjusted in the financial statements to remove that exception. I think that's the context in which we should ask auditors to supplementally provide more information. Clearly, they can make assertions about their audit approach because that's something that they're responsible for. But the assertions about the financial statements themselves, I think should stay with management. So the approach that you take, whether it be an ADNA or an emphasis approach, I think that's kind of like more form than any one of those might be possible. That's just the kind of the form that you would you'd put that communication into. I guess it might be easier or logistically easier to deal with it in a ADNA approach because you might be able to do that without SEC action. But at the same time, I wouldn't object to having auditors review and take some responsibility for the completeness and accuracy of management's assertion in the MD&A about critical accounting judgments and estimates. So whether they do that separately in their own communication saying how they addressed all the critical areas in the financial statements, presumably, hopefully you'd find a match between what they thought was important and what management was asserting were their critical judgments and estimates. But if there isn't that match, it's kind of a red flag. If the auditors identify 10 areas that they spent significant areas of focus on and management's only identified one, you'd say that there's something wrong there.
Thanks, Larry. Lisa Lindsley?
Thank you. I'd like to echo Larry's comments. As a consumer of financial statements, it would be very valuable to have the auditors review the MD&A, and whether you approach that from an ADNA methodology or directly with an MD&A, it would be helpful. And furthermore, I apologize for my ignorance, but I don't believe it currently exists, and it would be helpful to have auditors review the executive compensation disclosure that's in the proxy statements from the point of view of an investor.
Okay, thank you. Steve Rafferty.
Perhaps a few thoughts. Some of this, I think, is probably easy to get behind the notion of describing the auditor's responsibility for fraud and disclosures, and some of that stuff, I think, is pretty easy to get behind. There's some of it, though, that is, I think, maybe a good thought, but hard to apply in practice. I mean, I think, first of all, I come at this from the standpoint that if you ask people if they want more information, their answer is likely to be yes. So, I mean, to some degree, I think that has happened here. And I don't doubt that investors do want additional information. One question is from whom? And the second question is what additional information? And from some of what I've heard, you can almost boil it down to say they want to know what they don't know, and they want to eliminate as many surprises as they can. And when I look at the eliminating surprises, I look at there's future events that none of us can predict that we can't talk about in the financials because we don't know about them. But what they also want to know about is what are the elements of the financial statements that are most subject to change and why? And which ones are hard to get your arms around from an estimating standpoint as a preparer and from an auditor? And why is that difficult? So what's the volatility in the financials? I could certainly see a model where you would make a more robust disclosure. Maybe it's in the financials that would just boil all that down into one spot and say, where's the volatility in these financial statements? And I could perhaps see even the auditors confirming that their audit included procedures to test those areas of the financial statements that are most volatile. But where I do struggle is to say that the auditors can describe much about how they audited that would get an investor comfortable. I mean, you can't literally spend thousands and thousands of hours out auditing and boil that down to a paragraph that somebody says, gee, I learned a lot from that. I just don't think that's very, very practical. To me, it's a bit like if I get in an elevator in a 50-story building and I see the inspection certificate, I'm glad it's there. If you ask me, would I like to know more about what they did to inspect that elevator, I might say yes. I wouldn't have a clue what they told me. So I don't know what I would do with that information. And I think it will end up being boilerplate. It will end up saying, I, as the auditor, identified the same volatility issues that the company did. I did procedures to get myself comfortable, and that's how I arrived at my opinion. But I don't think there's going to be sufficient detail that most folks could really do much with. I mean, we heard earlier today that audit committees don't really know the right questions to ask, so I have a hard time understanding how many investors are going to get their arms around something that auditors could say in a couple of paragraphs that people would be willing to read. So that's the part that I struggle with. But I wouldn't have any trouble with saying, let's let the auditors confirm that they did identify the same areas and they spent time in those areas.
One of the things I heard you say, Steve, if I interpreted it correctly, was you're looking for some improvements in the financial statements, which would lay out particular risks in those financial statements, risks of potential measurement uncertainty, risks of volatility is the term you used, where numbers could change rapidly because of economic events, et cetera, to try to highlight in a particular footnote certain aspects that sort of might otherwise be brought out in this AD&A, put it in the financial statements, and have the auditor report on that. So that was an interesting variation on this theme. Thanks.
Joe, I know your card just went up, and I think I'd like to turn it over to you because I know you presented you had worked with other weather members on the IAG last week and made a presentation. So I think you might be in a good spot to articulate what you heard or the results you found from your survey, why investors want this information from auditors, why they think that would be helpful, et cetera. And I don't know if you had any other comments.
Well, I was actually going to not try to say much, but I wanted to respond to, and I think, Jennifer, you and Marty both on Tuesday and today did a pretty nice job of describing our major findings, and I don't think they were really very different than what you found when you talked to investors. What I thought was good was we did a questionnaire. Your staff did focus groups, and I thought they aligned pretty nicely. But I wanted to respond, hopefully reasonably quickly, to some things that Larry said and some things that Steve said. I agreed with 90% of what Larry said and was pleased to hear what he said. The only thing I would quibble with a little bit, and maybe it's just difference of perception, is if I heard him right, he was talking about keeping management making assertions and auditors doing attestations, and that's not unreasonable. But keep in mind that in going concern, Larry, in my view, the auditor really is making an assertion there. Now, you might say implicitly management is saying it's a going concern, and the auditor is saying we disagree with that, and so we could have a quibble about that. But I think there's new information being communicated by the auditor there over and above what's in the financial statements, and that's why it's valuable. With respect to what Steve said, a couple of things, Steve. You said if you ask people if they want additional information, they are likely to say yes, almost like this is a free good. And I would have tended to have maybe agreed with you. But in our questionnaire, one of the things we asked was, do you want additional information about audit hours? And it came back pretty definitively, no. And so it's not, they didn't view everything as if it's a free good. Just give us more, more, more. We'll take everything you want to give us. They differentiated. And there also was meaningful differences between things they really valued and things that, would it be okay, but it wasn't a big deal to them. Another thing you said is it would be hard to distill thousands of hours of work and thousands of pages of audit work papers into something that could be meaningfully conveyed in a more summarized fashion to investors. And again, I would quibble with that. Audit firms do that every day in summary audit memorandums. And summary audit memorandums lay out the major risk areas on the audit, what the team did, and how they got comfortable. And certainly the quality engagement partner relies on that. He or she also looks at the work papers. But I think firms could do this. It's not easy. I think it'll be challenging, but I think they could do it. I think the third point that you made that I want to say just a quick comment on is around boilerplate. And there I agree with you. I think one of the biggest risks with this project is that all you end up with is additional cost and boilerplate language. And that would be a huge failure. And no one would benefit from that, I don't think. Certainly investors wouldn't benefit from that. So I think one of the things the board has to think about very carefully, not just as it relates to standard setting, but as it relates to inspection and, if necessary, enforcement, is put in place a strategy where that will not be an acceptable outcome.
Thank you, Joe. John White.
Thanks, Jennifer. I think I'm not going to follow your three buckets up there on the slide, but I did listen to the meeting on Tuesday and a replay of the investor group, so a couple of observations, three observations actually from that. First, I guess I would say that auditor association improves disclosure and compliance. And I guess just from my perspective as a lawyer, kind of watching the sausage be made over the years when people are drafting disclosures and so on, and working on IPOs and watching the whole process, it's very clear to me that if you had auditors associated with MD&A, you'd get a better MD&A. If you had auditors associated with the earnings press release, you'd have a better earnings press release. It just comes out that way. If you had auditors associated with the critical accounting policies part of it, just the result of that interaction and the involvement gets you to a better product. Second, and I guess this is really the AD&A idea. At least for me, and I know a number of you have heard me make this point before, but I think that that if you have an AD&A or something the equivalent of that, where you basically have what I'll call dueling reports, dueling views, one from the auditor, one from the preparer, or conflicting disclosures, whatever you want to call it, I just don't think that's a stable situation, and I don't think you end up with that lasting very long, if at all, in what comes out for a company. I think that in the end you gravitate to what the auditors are, the auditors' views. I just don't think a company wants to be there with their auditors saying, I'm just going to say negative things about them, however it comes out. So I think at the end of the day, you drift towards the auditor view if you've got two views being expressed. And then you flip over from that, and this kind of gets to the standardization and boilerplate point, but I guess I also don't see how an auditing firm can have hundreds of individual engagement partners out there engaged in free writing, anything, whether it's an AD&A or whatever it is, it's narrative. So you are going to end up with some sort of standardization coming down from the national offices from the accounting firms. And so I think the effect of all this, it seems to me, ends up with the national offices of the accounting firms imposing standardization on the audit partners or the individual audits, and then you flow that the individual audits are going to, you're going to drift towards where the auditors are in each case. And I just, all of that doesn't seem to me to be a very good place for all of this to come out. And so, I mean, I realize this is a difficult issue, but if I sit here and think about how to balance it all, I think you're a lot better off trying to have as your goal figuring out how to come up with, I guess I would call it, one high-quality disclosure product for the investor, figuring out what the investor wants in that product, but one high-quality product that everybody agrees with. And with management having the pin on that, but figuring out whatever tools you need to give to the audit committee, give to the auditors to try to get an improved product. But I don't see what I guess I will call dueling products. And third point is cost. Inevitably, to me, I think you're naive to think that this isn't all going to cost more. Obviously, if you have the auditors associated with additional materials, that's pretty obviously going to cost more. But I think even if you have the auditors provide, and you talked about this a little bit at the earlier meeting, but if you have auditors provide information that you're going to say is already in existence because it was provided to the audit committee, it was done in this summary audit memorandum. Once you have a narrative that the auditors have to write for each company, I love Jay's example of the emails, but I'll just add my own example. I get telephone calls from clients all the time. I give them advice over the phone. You know, I charge whatever I charge for that. And then they say, well, could you give it to me in writing? I mean, have you dealt with lawyers? I mean, it just, if you're going to start writing opinions about it, if you're going to start writing it down, it's going to cost more. And I would suggest, actually, it's going to cost significantly more, particularly if you're focusing on the fact that this is information that investors really want. I'm not suggesting that it isn't money well spent, by the way. I mean, I leave that as a different discussion. I could easily see you deciding that an audit of MD&A was a good thing and is money very well spent. But to think that any of this is not going to cost more, I think, is naive. Actually, one other comment. The example you gave about auditors writing due diligence reports in M&A transactions, I don't really think that's the right characterization. Accountants that are hired for the acquiring company, acting forensically and paid for the acquiring company, write due diligence reports. That auditors don't do that. Accountants do it. I mean, there's maybe the same people, but I mean, it's not very different roles, very different functions. Anyway, that's my thoughts.
Well, the guess what? In connection with MD&A, since you said it wasn't the right example, you know, investors have told us that, you know, they say, you know, that they saw some similarities because they are the customer. Just, you know, if we could, you know, use a different term, you used accountant versus auditor. It's an accountant, not the auditor, but it's individuals with similar skill sets or, you know, providing information. Investors have told us, you know, that the auditors are working on behalf of investors. The audit report is signed to the board of directors and shareholders of the company. So that's the analogy they see. So, you know, we could have a discussion over differences. But I want to move on. I have five, unless another card just went up, but five cards to go through, and we've got about 10 minutes left. I know we have gone over in every session, but I think most people don't appreciate going over at the end of the day. So I'd like to, if you could try to keep your comments short to the extent you can, but it is important to us. So with that, I'll move on to Jim Cox.
Yeah, I was just going to I was going to make one of the points that John made, 4 points. I only had 1 point that would overlap, and that was the fact of this fear that it would be from a top-down, central-down sort of communication, that there wouldn't be this, John referred to, free riding, that it's not going to be tailored to that specific company, so therefore we'd be ending up with boilerplate. I think that's the challenge. The other thing was to say that we need to figure out how to greet that challenge, to get back to a point that I think Barbara Roper made a couple times today, is that as we move more and more away from principles and more and more principles away from rules, rather, that judgments and estimates, we need to know more about those judgments and estimates to be able to really understand the statements. And I don't think those statements are the auditor's role is necessarily to provide, as Steve was saying, comfort to the investors. I think actually we probably ought to provide some level of discomfort to investors so they'd have some greater textured knowledge about the range of outcomes that would be possible, and they'd have a better idea about how wide that variance is if we could illuminate to some extent what the judgments and estimates and et cetera that went into the preparation of the statements.
Thanks, Jim. Arnie Hanisch.
Thanks, Jennifer. I've got several points I'd like to make. First of all, I do support some change, so I want to say that at the start. My preference, however, is to look at existing reports that are in our annual reports and modify those reports as opposed to a separate auditor's discussion and analysis. I think that there are opportunities within the existing reports to accomplish much of what you want to accomplish. As an example, and I agree with Larry, that management needs to assert and the auditors need to attest, but there are many things that our auditors do. For example, they do review our press release. They don't attest. They review. They provide us with insight. They review our MD&A. Provide us with their insights. They don't audit it. You know, if we want in the management's report section of the financial statements, we management could possibly indicate some additional things that the auditors are doing, or in the auditor's section of their report, they could indicate that they reviewed the press release, one or the other, but not necessarily indicate that it was part of the audit. But as part of our due diligence, we had our auditors review the MD&A. We had the auditors review the press release. If that would provide the investors with additional information as to what the auditors do, I think that there are ways within the auditor's opinion, at least in ours, in the second paragraph, that it could be expanded to include additional disclosure around the areas, more specifically around areas that they audited, that would probably parallel, in addition to the critical accounting policies, that those were areas of focus, that there were other things of focus of the audit, which is what they tell the audit committee when they go through and they tell the audit committee what were the primary areas of focus, you know, whether it was in addition to the critical accounting policies, acquisitions, restructurings, asset impairments, their perspective on the current credit crisis that they reviewed, issues and financial instruments and investments we may have had. But those could all be covered in an expansion of the second paragraph of the auditor's opinion, and it wouldn't necessarily be additional boilerplate, but it would be specific to a particular audit. The other thing I guess I'd like to comment on is that I really don't agree at all with the auditors having to audit the MD&A. We rely upon security lawyers, and as part of our process, we spend several hours with our security lawyers, external security lawyers, to review the MD&A. We value their opinion because the MD&A, from a legal perspective, is where we would be called on the carpet as a company. It's management's view of the financial statements, and they provide us, our security lawyers provide us with their insights as to whether or not they think we've crossed the line from a disclosure perspective or not, or whether we need to go further because we're putting ourselves at risk as management with our MD&A disclosures from securities litigation. So I don't believe that it's the auditor's responsibility to audit that. They can review it. They can make sure that it's factual. They can make, which is what they do. They can review the numbers. And they can indicate that in the existing documents and the existing reports that are there. So those are my few comments.
That's interesting. Well, you mentioned some of the things that could be disclosed, which would be the auditor's review, the earnings releases, or press releases. Right now, that's not covered as part of the auditor's responsibility.
No, it's not. But I don't know if companies, you know, you could maybe build that into your auditor's responsibilities as part of your charge. I suspect that many companies, they have their auditors review their earnings releases, provide insight and comments. I value the insight and comment I get from the auditors, but I don't want them to necessarily be held responsible for it from an auditor's perspective. It's my press release.
We hear it's quite common, right, in larger companies that the auditors do that. Right.
Right. But I want to stop short of having them audit it and attest, you know, and attest to it. They review it. They provide me with insight, just like they do with the MD&A, and that's what we should maybe disclose. That they provide that additional service as part of what they're currently doing, if that would provide additional comfort to investors.
Keith Kelhar.
Thank you.
I'm not sure I was next, but I'll speak quickly on this. I think much of the information that you spoke about that the investors are interested in receiving is already provided to the audit committee by the auditors. So I just wonder how much of the information that we give to the audit committee is really something that belongs in the public domain or belongs only, you know, with those individuals who have that responsibility. So that's just something I'm just going to throw out there because I've seen pretty much everything that was requested on that laundry list of things has always been in the audit committee materials I've looked at. I think what's most important in the things that I ask is what did the auditor not look at? So in other words, what exactly did they do with the MD&A? We read it. We saw it was consistent. That's fine. Just, you know, say that's what we did. Proxy statement, same thing. Did they do anything? Did they just read it to see if it's consistent? Did they tick and tie the numbers? What did they do? So I think what's more important is the extent of the other financial information, which is not covered in all of the, you know, auditing standards, because I think there's a gap in understanding or the expectation of what people think the auditor's doing and what they're actually doing. So maybe to clarify that, not necessarily to go one step further to say they have to audit it, but just to say what really are they doing in that kind of the world of information that's very valuable to investor but may or may not be getting the same level of scrutiny. And I don't have any particular issue with, I think some of the risk discussions that I've seen in a lot of the planning memos that go into the, you know, the beginning engagement information that's provided to the audit committee, I think that information is actually very good and maybe something that auditors want to have out there. It shows some real thoughtfulness and I don't think any of it's really terribly alarming. So that's the kind of thing I would expect to see or hope to see. But other than that, I'm probably in the camp of not really sure that we need to make these changes. But if we're going down the path, then those are kind of my comments.
Thanks, Kiko. Lynn Turner.
I'd applaud Marty, the staff, and the board for taking this project on. It's been a long time coming. I think you heard last week that clearly investors aren't happy with the product, and not just from that group, but CFA Institute surveys, and also if you're going to keep the product relevant, I think the relevancy is a legitimate question. I think Damon actually did raise the relevant question there. Then I think you got to put out a product that the customer is looking for, because without that, I think maybe 10, 20 years out, the product is no longer relevant and people find another way, especially when we're paying, in some cases, as the board heard, hundreds of millions of dollars for a report that's no different in 2006 versus 2007 or 8 and 9 on many of these large financial institutions. So I do think you're headed down the right path. I think you'll hear in some of the SEC, FASB, PCAOB, public hearings this summer, you'll get some more feedback that I would suspect would be helpful. I do think there's a piece of this for the auditors. Investors want to hear from the auditors. They don't want to hear from the audit committee. They want to get the auditor's perspective, and the auditor's the one that can offer that because they're doing the audit. I do think there's a piece here for the audit committee as well. I think there's some pieces of that that maybe even are best coming from the audit committee, and I also think there's some disclosures that the FASB's got to come to grips with and get out there as well that should be coming from management as opposed from the auditor or audit committee. Again, I don't think you have to wait for the other two to do something. I think you can go ahead and move on your project without waiting for the others. The one thing that worries me is what John was talking about earlier. Anytime you let the attorneys get involved with writing this stuff, you got problems. And I think it's important that we don't get to where we just like what we've had with the audit committee reports. One of the reasons they've become, quite frankly, so worthless is so many of them were just written by the attorneys and they communicate almost nothing, more than what they used to, which was nothing, but they still aren't accomplishing what wasn't that good. And I also would hope that in the hearings that you held this summer, though, things like the auditor's attestation on MD&A are considered and put on the table because, quite frankly, this is one place where I'd probably differ from Arnie's perspective. I think the auditors are in a much better position to issue a report, not at the MD&A. And I think there's some information in there investors would like to see audited. And I think they're in much better position to audit that than the securities attorneys. So I think whether or not we need attestation on that and some of the tagging and the XBRL and all, I know that's controversial as well. But I think those are things that should be part of those hearings this summer because I think they raise some very useful questions and issues.
Thanks, Lynn. Okay, I've got Mike Gallagher, then to close it out, Gary Kaburek. Mike?
Thanks, Jennifer. A couple things. I think things will and should change. I think Lynn's point on relevance is a great one, and it's something that I think a lot about. I struggle a little bit with the practicality of how do we do it. And it gets back to John's point about thinking about my own firm, having 1,000 partners in the firm in the free writing business, and which is, you know, fine. You're gonna get subjective, and this gets to the subjective versus factual. You will get subjective information that's based upon an individual's point of view. And subjective information is going to mean different things to different people. Okay, and I would say that it would depend on your level of sophistication, among other things. And that wouldn't be so bad if it was the view of the firm, any one of the firms. But it won't be. It'll be the view of the individual partner. And, you know, depending on who that partner is, what is written could be very different. Now, you could run it all through the national office, as John suggests would happen. I think that's right. But I think then you lose the color that I think people are looking for. I think the likelihood then is that it turns into boilerplate. So I struggle with how to make that operational. As we communicated to Marty, that as we think about information that's going into the public domain, you know, similar to a medical oath, I think it should be first, let's do no harm. I listened to Larry, and I agree. I won't put a percentage on it like Joe did about what percentage of Larry's comments I agree with. But the notion of the role of the auditor versus the role of the preparer, I do agree with. And I think that there is an opportunity, to John's point, the more the auditor associates with, I think that does raise the game in terms of the quality of what's being associated with. So I think that's a positive. The point about AD&A, and again going back to Larry's comments, that perhaps it would be a red flag if the auditor, clean sheet of paper, had different items as critical accounting estimates than the preparer, that could be a red flag. I think theoretically that's right. As a practical matter, it would never happen because those views would get reconciled. And ultimately, as John said, the view of the auditor would prevail on that. And so you wouldn't see a lack of alignment there, which is the value of the red flag, I think, that Larry was talking about. So I think it's theoretical, but as a practical matter, it just wouldn't exist. So I know we're pressed for time, so I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Mike. Gary?
I guess if I'm, I have the last word, I better make it really quick since it's after 5 o'clock. But try to come up with some new points that weren't picked up when I wrote my first list here. But, I mean, let me begin with, I actually support changing the auditor's report, too. I might debate, is it all that important? But if the boards and the investors think it is, I'm by no means oppositional. And as I mentioned to you, some of the people here in the room last night, I think everything being discussed is physically doable. I mean, the information exists. You might debate, is it important enough? But everything on that slide is capable of being done. But understand that that comes with a price and a cost and in some cases unintended consequences. And a couple of ones that immediately come to mind. If you were going to have the auditor opining in the MD&A or at a very extensive ADA, is you're going to probably have to re-examine the, your standards on what is audit evidence. I would suggest you need to finish your communications with audit committee standards first, because I don't think this can get done absent how do auditors interact with the audit committees get resolved first, because I think out of all of this being done, I go back to some comments I've made more than once here, is that I still don't believe the auditor's role is to communicate any new financial information about a company. I think that's management's responsibility in it. And I do think the more and more the auditors are publicly getting associated with other things they do, is besides reexamining what is audit evidence, I think we should understand is the more and more you're being involved with stuff that's subjective or even forward-looking, the audit evidence is going to get weaker and weaker. It's one thing, you look in accounts payable, and here's the invoice, here's the check, here's the return check. That's pretty solid. But as you're starting to audit management's estimates, I think you start falling back, especially with their forward-looking estimates, if you're being associated with it, you're falling back to management's representations, no knowledge, no reason to disagree, sort of negative assurance type things. I think those are all consequences that I think will come out of this. And knowing them up front as you begin this journey, I think, would help, you know, the final product there. I certainly, you know, anything we, companies pay the auditors to do today, whether it's look at the MD&A, look at the press release, look at your known your default communications with your banks on borrowings and stuff, I think just reporting what they do on it, not necessarily a testing, but just, again, it gets more like a comfort letter, I think that's workable. I think in the critical accounting policies section, every company will have several of them, to give, like, I'll call it the French report style. Here's what we did in those areas. Again, I think we can debate, is it important enough? But I think this is what I did. I confirmed accounts. I observed inventories. I hired my own valuation expert. Just to say what you did, again, it's doable. Again, I don't know how much incremental information or, as Lynn pointed out, relevant information comes out of it, but it certainly could be done. Then my last comment is, what would be helpful to me as a preparer is if the investor advisory group here or a subset of them would come up with at least a consensus. What might a model auditor's report look like? And make up a hypothetical company, some hypothetical transactions, some hypothetical risks, recognizing they exist someplace in the world. And what would you like it to look like? Maybe there's more than one version of it, but it would really be helpful to see the what the investor constituency in this room thinks the final product should look like, then we can start working with it. I mean, you might never get there. It might not, might even finish the project, but at least having what does the endpoint vision, at least from one constituent, look like, I think would be helpful.
Jay, you want to make a comment?
Gary, I think we have a volunteer. I think it would look a lot like Xerox.
I said investor community. If you like a management view of what it looks like, I'll just pull the one out of our report today.
Thanks for those comments, Gary and everybody else. This, the auditor's report is a very important project. It has been mentioned a number of times. It hasn't changed in literally about 100 years in any substantive way, and investors are saying it's not a valuable product other than the audit is valuable, but the end product of the communication isn't. We're working diligently on this project, and we expect to get more information out. And, Gary, your comments about the extent to which we can lay something out in a concept release as to what it would look like, hopefully that can help respondents to the concept release give us a good input and address Mike's concerns about some of the operationality of this as well in the concept release. Very important project, and I'm very glad that everybody, as many of you, are willing to stay a little bit past scheduled time to discuss this. And I also just want to just take a moment and not keep you here much longer just to thank you all for the input we had during the day. We have a lot of important things on our plate. I mean, it's to make sure that financial statements are reliable and that audits are doing their job in ensuring that the financial statements are reliable and that there's high audit quality is the key role of what we do here in standard setting. And we talked about our standard setting agenda and changes in the accounting framework, internal control changes coming up from COSO, the importance of disclosures, and a number of very, very critical topics today. Everybody here worked very, very hard on our behalf today with all of the input that you gave us. This was not an easy day. It was a hard work day. And we very much appreciate the effort that you put in to sitting here and working hard on our behalf. So thank you for being members of this important group. We look forward to our next meeting and safe travels home. Thank you very much.